Today is the 19th of August 1980. I am John Forbes. I'm a poet. I've had poems published in The Age, The Bulletin, Southerly, Magic Sam, Year in a Wheatfield, New Poetry, Poetry Australia, Leather Jacket, the Vannucci Papers, The Nubile Brain, also in Compass, Surface Paradise, The Tasmanian Review and Aspect and other magazines and journals I can't recall at the moment. I've had one book and a pamphlet published. The book was in the Angus and Robertson's Poets of the Month series, in the first series. I've also been a slightly irregular editor. I was one of the co-editors of Leather Jacket, and I edit and produce a magazine called Surface Paradise. First issue came out in 1974. The second issue came out in 1979. Both issues sold out, and the magazine was, as a magazine, fairly successful. I have the material for a third issue, which I'll produce as soon as I have the leisure, because producing magazines is hard work, and it's not hard work, but it's boring, essentially. I must do it. People keep hounding me about it, which is, gratifies me to a great degree, because the myth of Surface Paradise has spread. In fact, one of the Canberra School of Poetasters, Mark O'Connor, not the Sydney Mark O'Connor, in fact, this is a point that should be recorded for posterity. There are two Mark O'Connors writing in Australian contemporary literature at the moment. One, far more prolific, but far less talented, is a chap from Canberra called Mark O'Connor. The other, who will have a book of poems, a pamphlet of poems published shortly with the same Adelaide press that is doing the poem I mentioned before, is Mark O'Connor. The book will be called So Far and No Safari, or Ode to Iggy Pop. He's a far better poet. He had about half a dozen poems published in New Poetry in the early 70s, but since then his scholarly pursuits have more or less not prevented him writing, but he's been more interested in studying weird Frenchmen of the late 19th century, and he's getting back into writing poetry now, and I think will do very well. Anyway, to get out of the diversion on top of the diversion, the Canberra Mark O'Connor was writing a survey of contemporary Australian poetry that he disliked, namely most of the poets who are in the New Australian Poetry Anthology. And he suggested that these people hang out in ghettos, and that these ghettos were violent, unpleasant places. He mentioned Fitzroy in Melbourne, Balmain in Sydney, and Surfers Paradise in Queensland. I was almost tempted to write and disillusion him about this, but it's such a nice myth to go down that I think I'll let it stay. To give some indication of the style of my poetry, I'll read one of my poems. One, I think, one of my most successful. It's called Stalin's Holidays. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. Juniper berries bloom in the heat. My heart. Bottoms up, comrade. The nicotine-stained fingers of our latest defector shake as they reach for Sholokhov's Lenin. The veranda is littered with copies. No, commies. The ones in comics like Battle Action or Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. Does form follow function? Well, after lunch we hear a speech. It's Stephen Fitzgerald back from Red China. Then you hear a postie whistle. I hear, without understanding, two members of Wolverhampton Wanderers, pissed out of their brains, trying to talk Russian. Try reading your telegram. Mes vacances sont finies, Stalin. But we don't speak French or play soccer in Australia. Our vocabulary and games are lazier by far. Back in the USSR, we don't know how lucky we are. I wrote that poem in October or November of 1976. I was cleaning my typewriter and I typed out the first line to check the keys, and about 75% of the poem came to me straight away, and it required about 25 or 30 drafts, which for me is Oh, no, less than that, probably 15 to 20 drafts, which for me is very few. I usually have to work on my poems quite a bit. As to the sort of genesis of the poem, I'm not sure. I never sit down to write a poem about something, because if I know what it's about, it tends to dry up. Because if I know what it's about, why bother doing it? I only do it for myself, in a sense. I mean, I'm pleased when other people like it, like everyone. I was very happy at the time, and probably the happiest I've ever been, because everything was going right for me, in a sort of no compromise type of way, which is fairly rare, as I've since discovered. Yes, I really don't know what to say about this. I think it's a great poem. I mean, great in inverted commas. I mean, it may look pretty trivial in 50 years' time or something, but it's one of the most successful for myself. Other people think otherwise, but given that it's going to be the title of my second book and my first really big book, well, really big, it's going to be about 60 pages, I'd let that stand as a sort of example of my work, or a typical poem that I'm happy with at this period of time. I began writing poems when I was about 16. I was living in Miranda with my parents. I had to write a poem for English class, and I got very interested in doing it. I was mainly influenced by concepts of beauty or imagism at the time, and wanted to write a poem that would be like a really beautiful, very early, something like 6:30 on a summer's morning. There was a bit of a gully near where we lived, and there was a lot of gum trees and that, and they looked. I used to have a room at the back of the house, and I could see this. And it was something like the same. I wanted to get into poetry the same feeling, or an equivalent of that experience or that sight. After that, I decided I'd want to be a poet, and I gave away my former career interest, which I'd wanted to go to Dun Truong, though the Vietnam War was on at the time, and I was against that. Well, initially I was in favour of it, but after I was 16, I was against it, and this put the kibosh on the army for a certain degree anyway. In fact, the attitude of all my teachers and my parents too towards culture was terrific, because they weren't consumers of culture in any sense, but they had a regard for it, as a sort of agnostic reverence for it. I mean, they didn't have anything to do with it. And I think this gave me an advantage to a certain degree over people who had been brought up to consume culture as a form of, and with genuine enjoyment, but to consume culture as a form of sort of class position. This, in a sense, really, I think, formed a lot of people into certain attitudes towards the concept of culture, of which poetry, capital P, is a subsection, and gave them, to a certain extent, predetermined attitudes. This is just in my experience of people I've come across, whereas with me, this wasn't the case. I used to write a poem a week, or try to. I read the Pulitzer in the local library. There was Bruce Dorr and Judith Wright and the world's most boring human being, Alex Carey. However, I couldn't make much of those poets. I was more influenced by the poets I studied at school, especially by Hopkins, and when I discovered them, the Imagists, and others who were so far in my past I've forgotten their names. The first poem I ever submitted to a magazine was a translation of Ovid into sort of Imagist stanzas. The first poem I had published was in New Poetry. I can't remember what it was called, but it started off, "Large areas of Germany are ravaged in my mind." It wasn't much good. That was in October 1969. I didn't have another poem published until late 1970. In the intervening period, I'd found some poets whose work I could immediately identify with, mainly through studying contemporary art. I think that's what made me alive to certain sort of formal style that I also found in these poets. The first one was that I came across was Ted Berrigan in his sonnets, and I was really knocked out by them. Also, I got through Ted Berrigan, I discovered the Ron Padgett, David Shapiro, New York Anthology. And practically every poet in that book seemed absolutely ace to me. There were some I couldn't get, but they seemed to have a certain sort of authority, a regard for the fact they were writing poems, not telling you their life story or doing a little sermon or something like that. Their poems reflected on themselves. Well, the poems reflected on the poem. They were autonomous. Now, those poets, it was John Ashby, Kenneth Koch, Frank O'Hara. The poem I had published was called Salute. The next poem I had published was a poem called Orange Sonnet, subtitled After O'Hara. It was nothing like O'Hara whatsoever, I realise now. It was what I made of O'Hara's lack of punctuation, or not lack of punctuation, no need for punctuation. Poems where the images reflect. But I think this is what all good poetry should do. Every image in the poem reflects on every other image. Reflects on might be the wrong word, a bit baroque. Modifies, changes the context or the sort of connotations. Mine didn't. I mean, I was trying to do that, but it didn't. I mean, not entirely. Let's see. Salute is, I think, a poem about... a lot of my poems are, in a sense, emotionally inspired, but it's not a direct inspiration. It's just because I'm feeling great. If I could feel great all the time, I presume, I hope, I'd write more that was good. I tend to suffer from Japanese poet disease a bit. You know, the limerick, there was a young man of Japan who wrote verses no one could scan. The last line goes, I always try to get as many words into the last line as I possibly can. Ponderous build-ups that don't quite come off. There's two things that bug me about my poetry. Present participles, which I seem to have got rid of, and similes, which I really like. Most of my poems that I wrote earlier, you know, 70, 71, 72, have got a lot of similes in them, and they work. But it's not so much I dislike them for their own sake. I just want to change. That's why I like Stalin's Holidays, because there's no poetic figures in it. I mean, a simile is philosophically a pretty suspect idea, but linguistically it's terrific, because if words were attached to their object, the simile would be very strange, except very obvious similes at the denotative level of meaning, like white as a ghost, or white as a ghost was white as a sheet. I'd like, for my own sake, I'd just like to get away from that to a certain extent, and I think I have. The trouble is that you tend to inevitably get into narration when you get away from a very direct sort of surface type poetry, and in that sort of that surface poetry, or poetry with a high degree of surface tension, I was very influenced by Kenward Elmsley and in a different way David Shapiro. This is John Forbes continuing on side two. From 1969 to 1973 I was at Sydney University. Over the period 1971-70-72 I wrote a number of poems, quite a few. In 72, I won the New Poetry Award with my poem Four Heads and How to Do Them. This was a big deal at the time, because 2 years previously, a couple of poets I admired quite a lot had won it, John Scott and Laurie Duggan. At this stage also, I met Laurie Duggan, Alan Wern, Martin Johnson. The way I met Martin Johnson's quite funny, actually. Well, when I first went to university, the highly visible poets around the place from Martin Johnson, Terry Larson and Andrew Huntley. And they were sort of the Black Cloak Brigade. And I thought this was terribly old-fashioned and bad news and self-indulgent. As you can see, my standards have dropped since then. And I was determined not to have anything to do with them until I had work published and they recognised me. Well, one night in the Forest Lodge, I was tripping and Martin was there. He was getting totally pissed out of his brain, as he did for about 18 months every day of the week after his old man died. Bill Antrim was there also. Bill Antrim at that stage had an amazing ability to find parties. If you whispered in one corner of the pub to someone quite close to you, there was a party on at some address, and Bill was over the other side of a room packed with 200 people. Come 10 o'clock, he'd be roaring around the bottle shop yelling out, "Party at XYZ," wherever it was. Anyway, there wasn't a party at our place that night. We were just going home to take drugs. And Bill Antrim invited himself back to our place, and he found there wasn't any party, but he brought in tow Martin Johnson, really pissed. And Antrim started to introduce us to Martin Johnson. And I was introduced to Martin Johnson. He said, "John Forbes?"
not the John Forbes. And I said, yes, and found out he only lived about 50 yards away from me. So we stayed up to about 5:30 talking, and I really, really like Martin. I mean, I disagree with him about practically everything, but I really like him. He's a really great bloke. He's in a very unusual position vis-a-vis contemporary Australian poetry because of his background and everything. I didn't see much social dimension to poetry in those days, and I'm glad I didn't, actually. I had terrific friends. I was really lucky that way. Only a few of them were connected to university, and I was living in the same house with them. Ken Searle, the painter, and Mark O'Connor, and Warren Robinson, and a couple of other, Gino Moliterno, a few other people, and they were all interested. Well, everyone was interested in art, but in a fairly, not in a sort of pretentious way. nothing pretentious about us. And this was a really good environment compared to a lot I could have had. After the 72 prize, I mainly published my poems in New Poetry because I knew Carl Harrison Ford and he asked me to, and because I admired his judgment as a critic. And as people have been pointing out recently, there was a real elan at that time. At the time, I thought that people like Adamson and Dransfield and what have you were old hat, but in a sense I was in the same wave as them, the same wave of enthusiasm, but not recognising it. I mean, my major influences were, I was very influenced by a girl called Robin Lee, who I met in fine arts, and by one of the lecturers in fine arts, Donald Brook, especially by his aesthetics lectures. At the time, they seemed to me to provide a very clear-cut way around a whole lot of waffle, which seemed to dominate a lot of poetry. And I was lucky I had this sort of training, but I think, I didn't have the sort of cultural assumptions that training usually draws in its wake, just through luck, really. I took a year off in 1972. 73, I did fourth year. 74, I started working on an MA. I'd got a grant at the end of 73 for $1,000, and I got another grant about 6 months later for $2,500. And I also won a travelling fellowship. It's called the Arthur Macquarie Travelling Fellowship in the Art and Practice of Poetry. So in 75, I had $6,000, which is the greatest sum of money I'd ever had. Well, it's the greatest sum of money I'd ever had in one piece before or since. And so I went overseas. I was incredibly unhappy. I was really miserable at the time. I spent most of 74 intensely depressed because I was extremely in love with a girl called Julie Rose. And it was the first time I'd ever, looking back on it, was the first time I'd ever wanted something and hadn't got it in a serious way. It sort of gave me a breakdown. I mean, Ted Berrigan says there's no such thing as a breakdown, and I suppose he's right, but it was the first time I'd really been unhappy, and I was thoroughly miserable when I went overseas, and got even more thoroughly miserable in London, which is natural enough. The odd thing about London is that I went there with training in English literature, and I watched a lot of Z-cars and whatnot, and I figured I'd know it, but it seems to me Australians are more foreign in England than they are in a country which is more ostensibly foreign, like France or Bechuana Land, for that matter. It's not called Bechuana Land anymore. That's the colonial name for it. We know the English vocabulary. We know the Australian vocabulary, which happens to coincide with the English vocabulary. The connotations around a whole lot of words are quite different there. And the sort of minute aspects of social mores are all quite different. Most of the time I was there, I spent the best time I had in England. I walked along the Ridgeway from Reading across to Avebury and then down to Bath, and then I walked down from Bath to the Mendips and across Somerset, and it took me about 3 weeks, and it was terrific. I really enjoyed it. The English countryside was like a park, and you were never more than a mile from a pub, even though you were in this relative wilderness, and it was possible to drink English beer, sort of. The other thing about England, before moving on, was the strength of the class system and how that affects their literary setup, because people are either middle class, and they're very middle class, in the sense that it dictates their whole way of behaving. My place I was staying in once, my landlady was a girl called Veronica, who's in her mid-30s, been to Cambridge in the 60s, been married to a scientist, divorced, and had two kids, one about 5 and one about 3. But she really hated me calling her son mate. And this woman was very liberated. I mean, she was into a whole lot of feminist, and she was very keen on various forms of meditation and whatnot, which doesn't prove anything, I realise, but don't call Jake mate. I remember that really well. I went to New York for 6 weeks and mainly bought books, didn't talk to anyone. Too shy to talk to anyone. It was August anyway, because they're all out in the country. Well, I rang Ron Padgett up, but I sort of made a fool of myself on the phone, so I never saw him. But I bought a lot of great books. Unfortunately, I lost them all in Amsterdam because I was drunk on the plane, very drunk. And by the time I got to Amsterdam, I was pretty rotten. So I got into Amsterdam, which reminded me of a sort of medieval Canberra, very well kept, but not very interesting. I went to sleep beside a canal and two guys knocked off my bag. Anyway, after that, I worked in Australia House for a while as a storeman, packing various things. Then I went to Greece, and I went to Crete, where I met Martin Johnson and Nadia Wheatley, who were staying in a little village outside of Harnia. I got there, and the one poem I wrote overseas, I wrote there. Someone had told me that a friend of mine, Ranald Allen, had got married. Anyway, I wrote an epithalamium for them. It's a poem that sort of, I mean, it's trying to make sense of this idea of marriage, because it's not something that people I know do. I mean, no matter how sanctified it is, or a-religious, if you stoop to the appalling bad taste of having a marriage celebrant in your garden. Well, see, those marriage celebrants and the sort of gauchery of their ceremonies points up the fact that the thing has no place. It is, even in its most civil form, it involves a woman accepting certain civil disabilities in the face of the law. For instance, if one's married and you're on the dole, you receive a combined dole that's less than the dole you'd receive if you're receiving one as two separate people. That is a civil disability. Not a bad one. It's not like having your ears cut off for walking on someone's property, but it's bad news. And these people were doing this, getting married. So the poem is sort of is about how it could be made a go of, as long as its limits were kept very severely in view, as long as you treat it like swimming and golf. Anyway, shortly after I wrote this, I came back home. Sydney seemed beautiful. I got off the plane in end of February, beginning of March, and it had been about 6 weeks of rain. It had been normal sort of February, and autumn started, and there was about 2 months of the most beautiful weather, and Sydney seemed so beautiful, clean, affluent, amazing. I found it very hard to get on with my parents when I got home. I couldn't stay at Miranda, and so I moved into the tin sheds and lived in the tin sheds for a while. Got a job at a hole of a place in Tempe in a foundry. Then I wasn't going to do my MA. I'd stayed away deliberately over time. I ran into Jim Tulip and he said, why don't you do it? And it was $75 a week, well, 65, but it went up to 75. So I started, got it back on it, but I didn't really want to do it, but I'd work at it about once every month. Once every 3 months, I'd work for about 3 weeks, not 24 hours a day. It was that period, late 76, I was writing my MA, and it was going well. And I'd met this girl I really liked, and I was meeting a lot of new people, and I really felt great. Learned to drink coffee. Well, I'd learnt that in Greece. Then I wrote the only poem that really sort of reflects experience overseas. It's called A Loony Tune. When I say it reflects experience overseas, I started writing it in 77 at an anti-uranium march. I was reading the TLS as I was walking along, and I read this review of some Russian novel, and they quoted a line at it from it and said, "And you, reader, have you ever vacationed in Nice?" And I thought it was a fantastic line, and the rest of the poem sort of accrued around that. But I changed Nice to Crete because I actually had holidayed in Crete. That was 77. I was living by myself then in Annandale. Still miserable. Well, was working a bit on my thesis. I got it mainly together. I should have typed it up. I should have had it submitted last year, but I haven't, so it's still hanging. The thesis was on Frank O'Hara. It's been a bit outdated. Had I published it when I should have, it would have been terrific. Anyway, on university and stuff like that, obviously I was trained to be an academic. Well, and I thought I would be too. But I decided I didn't want to be an academic. But working in a factory, or even worse, in the public service, which I tried for 4 months, factory's far better than that. You think of those guys in their rooms, the ordered calm of the Woolley building, the salaries, huge salaries, for sort of talking about doing what they like. But the fact remains, I don't think it's good because, well, maybe I could be the exception or something, or people will be the exception from now on. Maybe the rule won't apply from now on. But every poet in the country who's an academic seems to me to suffer from being an academic in terms of his poetry. I don't believe that business about because they study it, they're too close to it, and you've got to be a primitive or anything like that. It's not so much the content of the course, it's the structure of university, politics of... I mean, they're the elite of the public service, and the same sort of public service mentality applies in a very refined way. Anyway, I've regretted not being an academic since, in some ways, and I might still go into it, I'm 30 now, and it's not something you can get into when you're old, because now there's every year there's more fourth year people coming out, and now with the recession so bad, even people with first class honours don't necessarily get Commonwealth scholarships to do postgraduate work.